Thüringen, who's going to speak about spectral dimension of quantum geometries.
Thanks. So I want to present some work on the spectral dimension of quantum geometry.
You might have to speak up a little bit.
Excuse me?
Speak a little bit louder, please.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about some work done in collaboration with Gianluca Calcagni and Daniele Auriti on the spectral dimension of quantum geometry. So let's go to the motivation on slide 2. The main interest in spectral dimension, generally speaking, is as an observer of quantum geometry. So it's an important general goal to characterize the geometric meaning of quantum gravity states and of quantum history and new quantum gravity in spin form or group theory description. And the spectral dimension is one such possible observable. And it's taken by an expectation value of the heat trace, which implicitly describes the geometry of space. And as such, it's an indicator of topology and geometry, and it turned out to be a good tool to compare various approaches to quantum gravity as well. Actually, there are results in causal dynamical triangulation and asymptotic safety, which are relative gravity, non-commutative field theory, even some arguments in new quantum gravity already as well, and many more. And it also turned out to have interesting features there, such as, for example, dimensional flow, which is an interesting question as well to look at in new quantum gravity. If there is a dimensional flow and other fractal structures, then one might even aim at effective descriptions in terms of fractional QFT and intermediate regimes. So new quantum gravity is special in that here we have a combination of discreteness and additional pre-geometric data. So our heat kernel on spin networks is in terms of a certain discrete Laplacian, which is different to the approaches so far. And an interesting question then on top is how actually features of discreteness and geometry and of the quantum, such as position, interact. So let's start and go to page 3, where I give you an outline of the talk. I will start with the definition of the spectral dimension in general and in the discrete, for which I have to explain a bit more on the Laplacian discrete geometry, and then present you the notion of quantum spectral dimension, which I will take here. Then I will talk about properties of the classical spectral dimension in regarding topology and geometry as well as discreteness effects. And then finally go through the actual analysis of quantum spectral dimension for coherent states, for superpositions of geometry, and for superposition of combinatorics. And wrap up with the summary and outlook. So let's go, let's start with page 4. So the spectral dimension, in general, is a tool to extract information about geometry, as said, in particular by a scalar test particle, and more precisely by a heat kernel, which is the solution to a heat equation. And in this context, one can also alternatively take the interpretation of the heat kernel as the probability of the test particle to go from point X to point Y on some fictitious time scale in the diffusion parameter tau. On Riemannian manifolds, there's an expansion around the flat case, as described here. So the part before the sum is the solution to, for the flat case. And then one has an expansion described by geometric coefficients Cn and powers of tau to the n. And it's then the trace of the heat kernel, which alternatively could be taken as a return probability, from which one can see that the scaling in the flat case is just taught to the minus d-half, and one can define the spectral dimension as a notion of dimension as the scaling in more general terms on any geometry, which is then governed by a sum of geometric global coefficients. So we get an explicit definition of the spectral dimension as a logarithmic derivative of the E-trace. Let's go to slide 5. Where we now look at the definition in this on discrete geometries. So the point is that so far in the literature, people have either dealt with the purely combinatorial case, such as in causal dynamics of triangulation, where the Laplacian is basically an object of adjacent matrices, or in a smooth setting, where one directly gets the spectral dimension from some advanced dispersion relation. Both is not that directly at hand in loop quantum gravity, where we have discrete geometries. So we use so-called discrete exterior calculus to get a proper definition of a heat trace and spectral dimension in this case. And the result here is that one can have a definition, a precise definition of the Hodge-Laplace-Beltrami operator as in terms of differential d and co-differential delta acting on any p-form on abstract simplicial or also polyhedral complexes when they have a geometric interpretation, which is an assignment of volumes to the simple. And the case interesting for us is the Laplacian on dual scalar fields. So in the picture, the geology is here, the dashed lattice. And what you see here is the action of Laplacian on a field evaluated at some knot n, which then given by a sum over nearest neighbors with some coefficients in terms of volumes around the knot n, volumes of the adjacent faces between n and m, and the link from n to m. And I want to explain this a bit more in detail on the next pages. So let's go to page 6. So what we need here, what we define in the first place, is discrete field spaces. So our discrete spacetime again is, precisely speaking, an abstract finite simplicial Z complex K with some manifold properties, which are crucial to actually have a definition of a combinatorial dual star K and the geometric interpretation. So all kinds of volumes attached to the various P simplices for various P from 1 to D in general. And then we can have a bracket formalism for P form fields with the orthonormal and complete position base in terms of P simplices. That's as described here, and we can expand fields in the position space. In general, we stick here to simplicial complexes in the first place, only for precise definitions in terms of vertex sets. But our notation is already covered in the more general polyhedral case as well. So let's go to slide 7. For a precise definition, what we actually put down here. So we consider fields to be co-chains. So they're actually forms acting on chains, linear combination of simplices. And if there is we are in a cellular decomposition context, one can think of those as smearings over a simplex. But this is not necessary. It works all fine in the abstract case as well. And now the crucial point is that dual fields, so Hodge dual fields, actually taken to be fields on the dual complex star K. So we define the evaluation of the Hodge dual of a field on a simplex to be the evaluation of the fields on dual D-minus-T simplex, which is then taken to be just looked in the complex conjugate. And finally, we can go one step further and actually identify the primal co-change with the dual change and the other way around, as depicted in the diagram on the right side. And finally, as a consequence, get an inner product directly, just like in the continuum case, as a pairing of primal and Hodge dual form comes integrated over the home space of the volume measure. So let's go to slide number 8, where I present you how to define then calculus and the Laplacian in this setting, which is done, the differential is defined directly using Stokes' theorem as a definition. So the evaluation of a P minus 1 form field on a simplex P is just the sum over the evaluation of this field on the boundary of the simplex attached with the some sign and volume factor. And the same can be done for the dual fields on the dual simplices as well. And as already said before, the discrete Laplacian then directly gets the precise definition in the usual sense as d delta plus delta d. And let's go to page slide 9 and again look on the dual scalar Laplacian in this notation now. So it's exactly the same just in terms of the simplices now. And one can check that this Laplacian comes with the desired properties of a null condition and self-adjointness, which manifests itself in the symmetry of the coefficients in the sum or metrizability of the overall coefficient. And it's local in the sense that it's only a sum over nearest neighbors, which is directly related to the fact that the Laplacian is a second order differential operator. And we've also shown that for cellular decomposition, with manifolds, one can also obtain a convergence to continuum Laplacian under refinement. Go to slide number 10. So for the explicit context of quantum gravity theories, we actually have to express the needed volume factors in terms of the degrees of freedom or variables we're actually using. So we have given the explicit expressions in edge length on the d minus 1 phase normals or in 4 dimensions in phase by vectors, fluxes, or in area angle variables. That's basically applicable to all interesting cases. And by this, we have only some freedom in choosing the dual volume, which for the scaled Laplacian is basically needed for the dual edge length, because when one motivates a definition of volumes in a simplicial setting, one could either use barycentric or circumcentric dual volumes, as sketched in the figures here. And it turns out that from the properties demanded of a Laplacian, one might prefer the barycentric dual, which we will do, because only then we it ensures that the Laplacian has a positivity property on all generic geometries, which you already can see from the picture here on the right side. In the circumcentric case, it might happen that the circumcenter lie outside their simplices, and if that's the case for neighboring simplices, then dual edge length, for example, turn out to be negative. This spoils the symmetry. The positivity. So let's go to page 11. The last step for the evaluation of the P trace is to go to momentum space, which is quite straightforward in the setting of finite abstract complexes, as the Laplacian is basically a symmetrizable finite matrix in its component description. So as long as all the components given by the volumes are finite numbers, which is the case for at least for non-degenerate volumes, one has an orthonormal complete momentum basis in terms of eigenfunctions of the Laplacian. And this is an appropriate basis for functionals of the Laplacian, such as the Heap kernel. And if we evaluate transform now in the setting, the finally the heat trace turns out to be exactly just the sum over the spectrum of the Laplacian of exponentials e to the minus or lambda. So this concludes the the definition of Laplacian in the discrete. And now on page 12, I will provide you with the definition of the spectral dimension in a quantum case. So we take the expectation value on the level of the heat trace, which is similar to as it's done in causal dynamical triangulation. And then if you take this expectation value, you find in when expanding your state in some basis, finally that you get a sum over the base elements and the coefficients of the state, and then the trace is just over the exponential with the expectation value in the base of the Laplacian. Alternatively, as actually done in almost all other approaches, you could think of taking the expectation value directly at the level of the Laplacian as well. This would, in our case, turn out to give a trace over a product of exponentials. And this is actually not defined, in, for example, in a loop quantum gravity context, where our Hilbert space covers all kinds of graphs of different size, because just because the product of expectation values of Laplacian on lattices of different size is not defined. So we will stick to the first definition. This makes sense. And now let's go to page 13, where we'll line out the particular case we will use for loop quantum gravity state. We'll actually restrict to 2 plus 1 kinematical state, and further to only those graphs which are actually one skeleton of a combinatorial manifold in the sense explained above. And then in 2 plus 1 dimensions, so on two-dimensional states, the edge length operators give a complete set of geometric observables, which the network-based diagonalizes. So we can take the edge length Laplacian form and take it as a quantum operator, which basically acting on the network basis gives a function of the spin. We have checked that the heat trace in this description is indeed self-adjoint. More particularly, this is the case for an operator ordering of the length squared operator, where this constant C is larger than zero. Otherwise, we would have to exclude degenerate states corresponding to degenerate geometry. But we have done our later calculations for various cases of C, and we have seen that they do not crucially depend actually on the choice of C. So the further the reason for restriction to this 2 plus 1 dimension, in the first place, just the feasibility of calculation, because when we want to calculate the spectral dimension on larger complexes, the complexity grows exponential with the dimension. So in two dimension, we can do, we can get much more results than we have been able numerically far in higher dimensions. Another reason is that the definition is more straightforward because we have a full, we can express Laplacian in terms of a full commuting set of geometric operators. So other subtleties can be circumvented and we can directly look at quantum corrections. Okay, so this concludes the first part. So if there are any questions, now would be a good time.
Right, so if we look at your last motivation for D equal to 2 plus 1, so I'd like to understand a little bit more. So are the calculations so complicated for D equal to 3 plus 1 that you cannot put them on regular computers right now, or is it that you could do 2 plus 1 very, very quickly, like in a few minutes, and for 3 plus 1 you have to wait for a few days? Or how much more complex is it to do it in 3 plus 1?
So for the 2 plus 1 calculation, we actually will do some approximation anyhow, as I will explain later. And then for the more advanced calculations we will present, it was actually already on the order of, on the time scale of days. So indeed, to get the result of the same quality in three dimensions would be a significant challenge, which could be addressed by advanced numerical methods as well. So I would say it's not a principal barrier, but rather on the level we have got.
Okay, and the second point about the definition of the Laplacian. So in 3 plus 1 dimensions is a statement that there are subtleties, but you understand them and they're under control, or is a statement that there are things to be explored further, even in principle?
In principle, I mean, we have written down the Laplacian in all kinds of variables. So in principle, you could write down the operator as well. And then you would, for example, only have to deal with operator ordering issues and such. So we just set it aside. Yeah. Okay. More questions? Okay. If that's not the case, then let's go to part two. Properties of the classical spectral dimension. Starting with page 14. So we start very basic. With a smooth case here of the circle, and we do it because if we analyze later the spectral dimension of blue quantum gravity state, it's important actually to know the various features we can see there, which are just due to topology or later discreteness, and to identify the actual quantum features. So for the circle, one can directly get a closed expression for the trace, and then one can see that a typical topology effect is due to the compactness. One gets a fall off to zero of the spectral dimension plot, as you can see on the right plot, which can be easily understood. Such as in the return probability picture, in terms of that the particle after the fusion time scale of the size of the manifold will almost fully return. So the heat rate will turn constant and the spectral dimension will turn zero. This is very important for spin networks, actually, because so far we basically it's hard enough to deal with finite ones. There's not much known about infinite spin networks. And the geometry in this very simple case basically just sets the scale where the fall off happens. If we now go to slide 15 and generalize the circle to the torus, which is still possible in closed form, then we see that if all the geometric parameters, the radii, are equal, it's really just the default generalization of the circle. But if the radii are of different order, one actually can see what one would expect, namely a dimensional reduction in the classical usual sense of compactification, namely that a particle running around the torus won't see at a certain scale dimensions which are compactified on smaller scales, which in the plot you can see one example. Okay, let's go to page 16, where I have a short example of spheres. For spheres, while for the torus we below the scale of the topology effect, we actually got a plateau of the topological dimension. This is not true for the spheres for larger dimensions anymore. There we can obtain the topological dimension only in the limit of diffusion time going to zero, and the shape of the slope is slightly depending on the dimension. So we see here a geometry effect due to the spherical shape. Let's go to page 17, where I will now start to explain discreteness effect. So the most crucial discreteness effect actually is a fall off at the larger scale of the spectral dimension to zero, so in the small diffusion time regime. And in the plot, you see with a straight curve, case of an infinite lattice, and dotted and dashed, you see the spectral dimension of finite lattices. And one can see that they're actually these really converge to the infinite case, and we see that to get a plateau, to actually get a regime where we get the topological dimension, we need lattices large enough such that there is such a regime in between the discreteness effect and the topological effect. Let's go to slide 18. Because ultimately, for the networks, we are interested in triangulation. And already here, we haven't found any analytic solutions so far. So we start explicit calculations. So we define abstract complexes for torus triangulation in terms of standard triangulation of the lattice. And we have to numerically compute the Laplacian as described by discrete exterior calculus and diagonalize it to get the spectral dimension eventually. And you basically see very similar results as for the hypercubic lattice, only this discreteness artifact where we have a peak at a height above the topological dimension is slightly different to the hypercubic case, but then the plateau and the convergence behavior is just the same. On the right side, I always provide a complementary picture of larger triangulation, namely if I rescale the edge length such that the overall length scale is fixed, I can understand them as a refinement limit as well, so they're actually approximating the smooth torus. So this works well for these kind of regular triangulation. Let's turn to page 19, where the same is aimed at for spheres, but actually for spheres, we only have as equilateral triangulation attend boundary of platonic solids, and as you can see here for tetrahedron, octahedron, and icosahedron, they're much too small even to have a peak at the topological dimension. So as already expected from the former plot, you see that these triangulations are too small to with any interpretation of dimension. And the the most radical case for sure is the dipole, so the triangulation of the sphere in terms of just two syntheses, which turns out to be even independent of topological dimension, to have always a spectral dimension which is only peaking at the value of about 1/2. So the lesson of the last slide is really that to have a concept of spectral dimension as dimension, one needs complexes large enough. And this is also the case, this is the reason why calculations eventually turn out to be more complicated and really time consuming. So in the following, we will stick to the toroidal triangulation lattices for this reason. But I want to show you on page 20 one more aspect. If I actually take the torus and take a triangulation of it and subdivide it by Pachnermus, then I get even more features. So on the left side, you see the subdivisions by Pachnermus on all triangles simultaneously in the combinatorial sense, so with all edge lengths the same, which actually doesn't triangulate anymore the flat torus, so it gives some non-trivial geometry. And you see that we get oscillations around different body of spectral dimension, namely something from numerical integration 1.37. So here it's not quite clear if this is an effect of geometry or of discreteness, because on the right side you can look at the same Pachner subdivision, but now we scale all the edges such that it's still a triangulation of the flat torus, but still you see that the topological dimension is not reached anymore, such as in the regular triangulation case. And here it's quite clear that this is only can only be due to the precise combinatorics which we have used to triangulate. So this example shows that the combinatorics in itself already are very important for the actual dimension you obtain, even in the classical case of just one lattice. And finally, on slide 21, I give another example where I've done the same Pachner subdivision, but not simultaneously on all triangles now, but randomly. And in the on the left side, for the equilateral case, it's basically washing out of the oscillations, but still somehow similar. On the for the rescale case, we even lose any seem to lose any plateau which we had before, but we get a very much smaller plateau and a lower fall off. So the lesson here is really that the combinatorics of your complex really matters for the result of the spectral dimension. So let's go to slide 22, where I want to shortly summarize these results. So we have seen that the large scale behavior is basically governed by the topology effect, the small scale behavior by the discreteness effect, and we need an intermediate geometric regime for a concept of dimension. And the dimension in itself depends not only on the geometry, but also on the combinatorics. One could take the cases considered so far already in some sense as quantum, namely these discrete geometries in most cases could be related actually to pure spin network state. So in that sense, this all, already gives as an exploration of the combinatorial structure some analysis which could be understood as quantum as well. This concludes the part two. So if there are any questions.
Johannes?
And let's go.
Yeah? Yeah, I have
second question. Could you, in fact, precise what you mean by the note? In which sense do you say that the geometry is already quantum?
Okay, this might turn out, might be explained in the following section further, but briefly saying, if we evaluate the Laplacian or the heat trace on a spinetric state, we exactly get the Laplacian on a discrete geometry according to the length spectra of the spinetric state. So for a pure spinetric state, the excitation of a pure spinetric state will give just an evaluation of the spectral dimension on the corresponding discrete geometry.
Is it true for like any gauge group, or both the Lorentzian case and the Lorentzian case? Or?
Okay, so here we really restrict to the Lorentzian case and SU2, to the spectrum. But for this argument, actually, this would be even more true for continuous spectra, because then you with pure state you would obtain all kinds of discrete geometries, while for SU2 with discrete spectrum you only get discrete geometries in a double sense, so also with discrete values of the length.
Okay, thank you.
One more question. For those of us who are not in the game, I would like to understand what you mean by combinatorics. Do you just mean subdivisions, or the way that discretization is carried out, or what? I mean, combinatorics of what matters?
Exactly. So the precise example here was various triangulations of the same smooth geometry, but with different combinatorial structure. So at first I showed these more regular triangulations, which really approximated the topological dimension, the bare spectral dimension. And then later I showed the subdivided triangulation, in particular the random subdivided triangulations, and they gave significantly different spectral dimensions. So this was the basic point.
Is a statement that the continuum limit is achieved kind of at different rates for the different subdivisions, like the for example the two that you just pointed out, is that what one is saying here, or are you saying that
that's true? I mean, I haven't made any claims on the infinite triangulation or infinite refinement cases here, as I have been able only to do these numerical calculations on finite sizes. But from these results, one definitely would conjecture that in these limits, one would obtain different dimensions.
I see. So it's not a matter of just that you would get the continuum dimension at different rate. That is to say, you have to do much more refinement. But really, no matter what refinement you do, you would get different dimension if you used one scheme versus another scheme. That's what your expectation is.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, then let's go to the third main part, the analysis of the quantum spectral dimension. And let's start with slide 23. So now we really want to look at quantum states, and especially to explore with a notion of quantumness, dependence of the spectral dimension on the quantumness of state. So the first thing to do is definitely to look at coherent states. So we look at states on a given graph, peaked on on a set of spins, and also on an extrinsic curvature. But when we evaluate this in the classical Gaussian in the semi-classical regime, actually the phase factor due to the curvature drops out, and the expectation value of the heat trace turns out to be basically a Gaussian sum of a Gaussian distribution. So the goal here is to first, for sure, to check that it's indeed semi-classical state, also on the regarding the spectral dimension, and on the other hand, to identify quantum corrections. And the challenge, as I already said briefly before, is size. So in this case, the size of the sum grows exponentially with the size of the complex, so with the number of links. Even if we would take a cutoff on the spin, but I mean even more so if we don't and only have the effective cutoff due to the Clebsch-Gordan conditions on the node. So for this reason, we implement these calculations by approximations by doing a sum over some random samples. According to the measure which is effectively used in, which effectively the expectation value of the heat trace is described by. So here, the Gaussian. And on the right-hand side, you see the result for various values of spins. Here, all spins taken the same on all edges. So we are peaking, we want to peak at the equilateral, regular equilateral triangulation of the force. And as you see already, there's only very small deviations. So let's go to slide 24, where I give you the plot of the difference of the expectation of the quantum spectral dimension to the classical case which the coherent state is peaking at. So we see first that it's indeed very close to this case peak set. So the semi-classical
behavior is
very good. And the deviations are only of order 10 to the minus 2. So, and maybe I have to say it more clearly here, that it's really what we identify here now as quantum corrections is not the difference to the topological dimension, but different to the classical discrete geometry with the discreteness and topological effect. So we are, by this, dividing out the effect. And let's go to page 25, where we have checked the dependence on the spread and the coherent state. And as you can see, the results are very similar. The deviations, again, are only of order 10 to the minus 2. While here, it's a bit unclear, anyhow, how to interpret the quantumness as dependent on the spread, as the most in classic case would actually be spread where the state is the uncertainties for intrinsic as well as extrinsic curvature are minimal. While for the spectral dimension of the spatial state, only the intrinsic geometry actually matters. But anyhow, we see that the deviation is very small. So let's go on our search of quantum effects of spectral dimension now to the slide 26. So beyond coherent state, one typical source of effects of quantum theory in general is the superposition. So one natural idea, furthermore, is to look at superpositions of states over various geometries. So we here stick to one graph where the spins are defined on, the states are defined on, but we peak now on various various spin configurations. And this approximation now is not only for the semi-classical regime, but we also do some approximation on the cross terms in the sum over coherent space here. And now, again, as before, there's a difference whether we take on the left side and interpret our state as peaking on the same geometry. So we take the various spin configurations just as various levels of quantumness, but still all states are peaked on the same smooth geometry, where we can see that, again, the deviations to the geometry peak zone are very small. We find, again, only deviations of order 10 to the minus 2. Or if we, on the right side, look at superposition of states indeed peaking at geometries at tori of different scales. There you can see that the effect basically for the expectation value is some kind of averaging. I mean, it's not exactly an averaging because the expectation value is taken on the level of the heat trace and the spectral dimension is only scaling, so dimension derivative. But still, for if we do it on a if we do the superposition of a few lattices, namely in the right plot, the triangulation plotted with dash and the dotted curve, it looks like some kind of average. The same is actually true if we go to slide 27 and explore superpositions now not in the spin, but in the graphs themselves. So we use the above triangulation. And now, because we have seen that the deviation of coherent states are quite small for reasons of numerical feasibility, we actually just take them sharply peaked. So we just take take single configurations and sum over over various triangulations. And again, you can see on the left side, when they are interpreted as peaking the same geometry, some kind of averaging, as well as on the right side, when they are peaked on different scales. Let's go to the next slide, 28, where we have done it not only over a few lattices, but now here over 40. There we can see that the averaging becomes more interesting for large sums, in the sense that here we could start to conjecture about some convergence of the spectral dimension, especially of this in the geometric regime, for even larger or infinite superposition sums. But unfortunately, with the techniques used here, much larger triangulations, superpositions are actually not feasible. So let's turn over to slide 29, where I summarize on these results from the quantum. So what we have seen is that for coherent states, the approximation to the classical geometry works very well. Quantum corrections are surprisingly small. And only if we explore superpositions of geometry peaked at or superpositions of graphs, we get a large effect due to these non-trivial averaging, as I have shown you. So what is work in progress at the moment is to use more refined and other calculation techniques, where we actually have indications that if we take very large superpositions, so of order 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 states in this position sum, in two dimensions, we actually don't see a convergence to topological dimension 2. But the dimension 2 seems to be special in that because if we do the same for dimensions larger than 2, I wanted 2 to have here. So starting with dimension 3, topological dimension 3, we actually have found we are working on some superpositions where we even can see a flow to the ultraviolet to a spectral dimension of 2, independent of dimensions. So we're working on this. Another thing we are still working on is to include the spin foam dynamics and evaluate the heat trace inserted in a spin foam state gun, but where new features such as imaginary contributions appear. So it's not clear that the heat trace in that context is an observable in the usual sense, but it might turn out rather to be might turn out rather as in the transition amplitude in a more general sense. So let's wrap up the whole talk. As a summary on page 30, I've showed you discrete in what sense discrete geometry demand a new definition of Laplacian, for which I've shown you an extension of discrete axial calculus to discrete quantum gravity cases. I've shown you a concept of dimension. I've shown you that the concept of dimension actually is only possible to obtain for large complexes. And we have developed techniques to compute these observables of state of geometry on large complexes, and found that semi-classical states provide good approximations, and so far stronger quantum effects don't show up. And a very crucial result, I would say, is also that the dependence on the combinatorics of the state is very dominant. Going to page 31, as an outlook, one thing to do is for sure to look not only at the spatial dimension of space, but also on the space-time dimension, so the evaluation of the insertion of the heat trace in path integrals and spin foams and TFT is a very important next step. But in particular in the case of Fourier theories, where we have to sum over all kinds of complexes as well, it might be crucial to use analytic methods. And one way to do so is to look how to generalize the analytic results obtained in random trees, dynamic strangulation, even recently in tensor models, to include some kind of geometric data related to quantum gravity. Another thing one which would be interesting to do is to use discrete calculus for model building of quantum gravity models, and directly on the discrete level, not as discretization of smooth action. In particular, metacoupling would be interesting, and this also in particular because it would be generally interesting to use the methods developed to analyze other geometric observables, because this seems to be really the an important aim to check the geometric and continuum properties, especially of loop quantum gravity state and history, which are not too well understood so far, I would say. Thank you.
Questions?
I have one question. Reading in your analysis the non-commutativity of the geometry, are you taking it somehow into account or just neglecting it?
Um, So far, still I'm not sure if I understood the question right, but I thought it was about the non-commutativity of geometric operators used here. And so the answer would be that we get the so far with all these calculations in the 2+1 case, where we have a full set of commuting operators at hand to define the spectral dimension and the heat trace. So we have circumvented them so far for reasons of feasibility of calculation. Does that answer my question?
At least, okay, this is because you are in 2D, but in 3D, where would you expect the non-commutativity appears? I mean, you treat spin networks as if those are just essentially classical discrete objects. This is true when you take into account the area, for example, but if you look at the length, the lengths are non-commuting objects, and so in doing your computation, you should diagonalize each time your Laplacian, for example, for different configurations. You see what I mean?
Yeah, totally. That's true, and indeed, this could be another source of interesting features of the quantum spectral dimension. In that case, especially one might even expect some dependence on operator ordering, right? It's basically we haven't come farther so far, basically because of the problem that you really have to take these large complexes to be anything at all, and generics are quite involved then already. It's also the reason why I can't present more on spin forms, which I've been working on as well, because there it's even harder to find approximation of it. So maybe new methods have to be developed as well as to evaluate on such large complexes. On the other hand, I don't know anywhere else where any calculations on such large triangulations have been done so far.
Okay, thank you.
More questions?
Johannes, I have a bunch of questions which are all related to more conceptual conclusions that you did not emphasize. So I want to understand that we have understood those things correctly. The first thing is that I don't understand your superpositions of coherent states. Particularly if I go to coherent states with different values of J, right? Because in ordinary field theory, so if I take two coherent states which are peaked at two different classical configurations and I superpose them, that doesn't look anything like a classical configuration.
Yes.
So I would expect that I don't see why it is of interest to superpose coherent states which are peaked at two different values of J's. I mean, what are we trying to conceptually get at by this superposition?
So this is, in many sense this is just very explorative work. And basically, because we have seen that for the coherent state, we don't see any more surprising results. We've just played around and looked for other states. I mean, these superposition states for sure are in the Hilbert space as well. So we've just tried with some ideas of what of the notion of quantumness, other states, where looking for features. But I totally agree that in the first place, such a superposition, has no straightforward interpretation.
Okay, but on the other hand, the last superposition you considered, which was with different graphs, and you had a parenthetical remark there that the graphs are perpendicular or something like that. If I go to, for example, the slide 28, so you said that the graphs are orthogonal. So that means that they are, does it mean that these graphs are different locations in some sense.
This was just a bit imprecise. So the orthogonality assumed here is just on the related spin network states. So we assume that spin network states on different graphs are orthogonal, which depending on the on your definition need not be the case.
Okay, but in that case, I mean, presumably these graphs may or may not overlap with each other. Is it the case that you also consider the possibility that these graphs do not have any overlaps at all?
So you could take you could take two accounts of this. The first one is to really consider all the graphs here as fundamentally abstract. In that case, you might not consider them as overlapping in any sense at all. But on the other hand, we are actually peeking at complexes which are triangulation of a certain smooth geometry. So if you go to an embedded context, for sure, exactly these graphs actually would really overlap because they are basically refinements of each other. So this depends on your interpretation of the state.
Okay, but then if they are refinements of each other, then how could the states, coherent states, be orthogonal to each other? Because coherent states would always have some components. So you're still making coherent states orthogonal to each other by, even though you are refining, is that the claim?
The general starting point was to still use coherent states, but actually on slide 28, I say that we actually use only states in a position which are sharply peaked on J. So sharply here really means no contributions other than these J. So in this actual case, we don't have any other contributions. So indeed, here I would say there are really no overlapping states in the sum. But it might be interesting as well to look at these. But from the considerations above, typically because it's basically a Gaussian sum, the overlapping, the cross terms can be neglected. Also because we have seen before that the contribution of effect in the spread of coherent states is rather marginal. This is not conclusive. It could be that in this particular case they somehow multiply, but it's just some approximation in this case.
All right, thank you. So now the second set of conceptual issues, it really has to do with what you call dependence on combinatorics, which is to say the way you have done the refinement, right? I mean, you can do a regular refinement or you can do a random refinement, and you can use one move or you can use another move to do refinement. And the statement that you explained to us was that the results, your expectation is that the results, even when there is a large number of vertices, you are approaching continuum limit in some sense, appropriate sense, even then, this combinatorics, the way that the refined lattice, the way that the limit is taken basically, will not agree and will keep a memory of the discrete structures that you used in the family. So if this part is correct, then two questions. One is, then when people in CDT say that they have a spectral dimension and they do the classical De Sitter space, which by which they mean they get a sphere, your statement would probably be that, well, that is true with a certain kind of discretization. But if I took a continuum limit using some other kind of discretization, I would actually get even the dimension not the dimension of the stratosphere. Is that is this what you would say?
This is what I would say, and the point is that in causal dynamical triangulations, as far as I understand it, they have a definite description of what kind of triangulations are in the ensemble and how they are weighted, right? So they're just doing the straightforward numerical calculation, and they find their values. Maybe if you modify the ensemble, and actually you see you see even the various phases, right, in dynamical triangulations. You see that there are phases where the spectral dimension is that of branch polymers, and there's cases where it's that of a continuum manifold. I mean, eventually this is the how the spectral dimension historically was introduced to the field, because people in dynamical triangulation took exactly this this observable check on what actually phases they're in with their ensembles.
Right, but I mean, my general understanding or general qualitative picture was that there are kind of universality classes of refinements, and so you are saying that, if I understand what your results are suggesting, is that in fact this is a very delicate matter, that different refinements will just give you quite different results even for spectral dimension. So you have to take the limit in a very delicate way, as for example Bianca has been telling us. Is that correct? Is my understanding correct?
Yeah, I would say that, yeah.
So the last thing is really then, again, looking at coming back to spin forms, and it is related to this also, about the continuum limit and so on. So your statement again would be that if I just took by... Okay, let me step back one step. That you also had a statement which said that, well, to have a well-defined spectral dimension, one needs a large number of vertices, right? And one needs a large large complex. So when people take something like, you know, a single or a few simplices and take large J's and want to say that that is a classical limit, that seems to go against your general picture. Am I correct about this?
This is true. Here in this case, I'm only considering the spectral dimension. So I'm considering a geometric quantity which is defined by an integral over the whole manifold, right? So in this case, for the spectral dimension, I would definitely say it's true. It could still be that you can extract information from just the local of certain more local geometric quantities by just looking at locally at parts of smaller complexes which you might understand as part of a larger one, and that for those geometric quantities you can find all kinds of interesting results. Only for the spectral dimension, indeed, it seems to me, at least from what I've presented, that you really need the large complexes to obtain a proper analysis of spectral dimension at all.
Okay, very nice. So therefore, it looks like there are kind of classes of observables, some which are more global, like the dimension, and then some which might be a little more local. Do you have any feeling, you or Daniele or anybody else, have a feeling as to how to distinguish between them? I mean, what would be good observables for which just a few simplices would be fine, and what would be good observables for which, spectral dimension being one case, for which, in fact, you need a lot of simplices. I mean, do you have any feeling, understanding of division between these observables?
Yeah, from the analysis we have done so far here, this really only gives hint at the global cases. So I wouldn't know how to break this down. I mean, only for such a global object, you can see from the final calculations at which level you start to be able to tell anything, like when you have this geometric regime, which was typically the case at lattice size of 10 to about 10 to the 3 vertices. But then to speculate about other observables which need smaller, only need smaller lattices, I don't know.
Okay, so you're saying that conceptually we really don't have a good handle on a distinction between the two types of observables, or at least we don't understand that there may not even exist a class of observables for which much smaller lattice sizes would give you a faithful result. At this stage, everything is not an open issue. Is that correct? I mean, is this compatible with your understanding?
As far as my knowledge goes,
I just want to make a short comment to one of Alois' previous comments on this dependency of the spectral dimension of the refinement you're taking. So when we were looking into the higher dimensional formulation of the theory, and when you there implement the simplicity constraint, you find that your quantum states, up to some subtleties in the diffeomorphisms, are always basically SU2 spin networks. So they carry the same quantum numbers as an SU2 spin network. If you just write down some spin network and consider or try to figure out its spectral dimension, you shouldn't be too surprised if things look weird there, because you're a priori not sure to which dimension it belongs, just considering its quantum numbers, and also considering that, I mean, these heat kernel things and so forth would look exactly or basically exactly the same in higher dimensions up to some small correction. So,
More questions? Okay, let's thank Johannes again.